Cowdery and Charlie Huggins, should we say paving or rutting?
Pavement rutting.
Paving. That was a good idea. I didn't put that in there.
Yeah, time is 13:45. And Jerry, why don't you go ahead and introduce Leroy and yourself and...
Yeah, or go ahead, maybe, and Leroy can talk about the university and introduce us.
Okay, I want to begin by thanking you all for giving us the opportunity to be here today. I am with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm a professor in the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department, and I'm the principal investigator on a project that you funded to look at Anchorage pavement rutting problems. And within that...
get his name.
Denali Materials is here with me, and we're involved in trying to solve this problem.
Yeah, Jerry, or Leroy, make sure you say your full name. We have to get that for the record.
Okay. Jerry Desardes is here today with me to make a presentation before you concerning this status of our research. Let me begin by saying that at the university, we have a graduate student that has been working on this project that... has been working for Denali Materials for some time and has come to work with us as a graduate student, as a master's student, to get a master's in, I would say probably pavement engineering will be what he'll have as a master's program. Fortunately, he has also got a master's in chemistry, so he brings that to the table. When we started this project earlier this year, I won't go into all the details of getting test samples and all that because we have a formal presentation to discuss that. But part of the process is to get to look at a couple modes of failure. One of those has to do with studded tire wear, and the other is plastic flow. And we are addressing the plastic flow issue. So in order to try to understand that, we did a complete literature search on the subject. And then I sent our graduate student to Washington, D.C. At the annual Transportation Research Board meeting, which is an opportunity for about 10,000 researchers to get together annually to share their experiences and their understanding of the latest technology and what we're doing in the transportation-related fields. I sent our graduate student to go there to exchange and understand and go to committees and be able to... share with the latest researchers. I also then sent him to Turner Fairbanks at the FHWA test laboratories to look at the latest testing equipment and to see what they knew and spend some time with their researchers and to see what we can learn from that. I then sent him to Carolina at their test labs to take advantage of the latest technology that they're using in testing pavement materials for plastic flow in their labs. That's an East Coast experience. Following that, we have since requested for both mixed designs and construction compliance reports on the test intersections that we've also taken, that Jerry will explain here in a moment. And we'll get to that as part of our literature search. And then once we've got all that put together, I'm going to send, again, the graduate student to Colorado. And the reason I'm sending him to Colorado is that's one of the latest state-of-the-art technologies that they're looking at plastic flow again, but that's a West Coast aggregate kind of issue. And so that way we'll get both an East Coast, which is crushed aggregate versus river run aggregates, and try to get a handle on both kinds of material sources that goes into an asphalt pavement. At that point in time, we'll put together a thorough testing work plan to be able to evaluate effectively what we believe will answer the questions to what we have before us. We have already got some preliminary findings that we can share with you today, and we're excited about that. So with that, I think I'll just stop and let Jerry go ahead.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Leroy. Nice to be here and good to see you guys again. I think it was just about exactly a year ago today that we were down here, that I was down here last talking about this. And So we felt it was time. We have got some preliminary results that I think are quite interesting, and that'll direct our research from here on out, and I thought it was worth coming down and reporting it to you. My name, incidentally, is Gerald J. DeJarlis. If you need the spelling, I can get it to you. Okay. This was the one of the slides I presented at the session the last time I was here, rutting is contributing to premature failure. It's a safety problem. It's expensive, and it's public. It contributes to public inconvenience. So the scope of work which we have on the research grant request was review previous work by Alaska DOT, solicit data from other states, identify causes of rutting, test to identify rut-resistant pavement material, analyze data to develop appropriate pavement sections with those materials. And we have pretty much completed down through this point right there, we think, pretty close. We think we've got a pretty good handle on that now, even with this fairly limited study. The possible causes of rutting are plastic flow, which is a function of mixed design, and also constructability, which means the testing on the job. In other words, to ensure that the material you're putting down on the grade is truly reflects what you designed in the lab. So that gets down to the testing end and the management of the production of it. Studded tire wear, base and sub-base failure, stripping and raveling those are the four things we looked at to see where the problem lays. The subgrade failure, for example, would be in this case where the subgrade is failing, and so as a result, the pavement, it being a flexible pavement, will tend to deflect. The other kind is plastic flow, where it actually, the subgrade is stable, but it actually flows under load from the traffic over it. This is Tudor Road when they were before they overlaid it this last year. And as you can see, and this is typical of all seven roads we tested, seven actually, there was no evidence of subgrade failure in any of them. In other words, you can see it, it doesn't really show it maybe, but that's as flat as can be across the bottom of that pavement. There is no deflection. That is pure plastic flow of that mix. The sampling locations we used were the Glen Highway at Muldoon Exit, Diamond Boulevard, Old Seward, Tudor Road, Tudor and Bergaw, Gamble and East 13th, Benson and Old Seward, Bergaw and East 6th, and then the new pavement on Tudor Road. We took a series of cores in the travel lane and between the lanes so that we could get a comparison of what's going on and see if we could deduce what's happening on the pavement. This is fairly typical. This is Tudor Road, in fact, fairly typical of a pavement that has experienced plastic flow. You look, you can see in the wheel tracks, you get flushing. The asphalt being flushed to the surface as compared to in between the tire tracks here where there is no flushing. And that's pretty typical in all these. It's doing that. It's flushing the asphalt to the surface.
Does, Mr. Chairman, yeah. Does weight, like trucks, have a greater effect on this than, say, a light car?
Oh, I'm confident it does. You bet. I'm sure that's a factor.
I mean, it moves around.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a factor. The wheel loading is a big factor in plastic flow, in any of these, in fact.
Jerry, in that respect, one of the discussions we've had about the transportation of pipe for the gas pipeline, mm-hmm. over the roadways, and the conclusion that I think some of us came to is that if we tried to do that by truck, we'd destroy the road infrastructure that the trucks use because the pipes were so large, so heavy, mm-hmm. and would be an overload just with one pipe.
Yeah, and it's a factor. But on the other hand, now bear in mind the subgrade is not failing, and the ones we tested and the sites we worked, the subgrade was holding up. So we're building good roads on the heavily traveled road. We're building good grade. We have a mix problem.
Right.
And I think we can solve a lot of that just in better mix designs, to be honest. But it's a factor. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. But if we, let's assume for a moment that we get the mix right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if we put it on road that the roads that have a subsurface, how much of a factor have we taken away, and how much will it continue In other words, we're resurfacing a road that's been resurfaced, I don't know, three times before.
Right. Hello.
Hey, Carl, join us up here. Let the record show that Representative Carl Gatto has joined us.
What I'm showing you here, incidentally, we have, I think, about 25 pictures to show you. This is just a tiny portion of the data we've collected, but we have a lot of data on that very thing, and I'll show you a slide or two of some showing what we did is when we took these cores. Then, as you can see, there's various layers of lifts of mix, overlays there. We cut those apart, and we measured for plastic, for voids. Mm-hmm. And what we're finding is that the vast bulk of that occurs in the top lift, that it doesn't transfer hardly at all.
Oh, really?
It's surprising, but it doesn't.
Interesting.
Yeah. We did find on the Glen Highway that the second lift, the one underneath the top lift, is deteriorating big time. It's fallen apart and it's flushing. And we don't know for sure why, but we did find that. And the Glen Highway still is holding up pretty good. It's rutted a little, but not bad. This is typical of the cores that we cut there, and this... The assumptions we made on this, or what for a direction in our testing, we did quite a little. His name is Javed Ahmed, the fellow who's the grad student that's doing the research work in the lab. And in that literature search, he found a rather extensive study done by several different outfits. One of them was by Tony Barter and Johnson. I don't know Johnson, but I knew Tony Barter pretty well. They reported in a study they did that Alaska spent $5 million annually to repair stud-related pavement damage. And I think that, to be honest, that you can't fault them, because we haven't found anything that really has been done to establish the fact that, yes, studded tires are the cause. It just was kind of an assumption. People just all assume studded tires have to be eating up our roads. And I think in practical fact that plastic flow may be as big or bigger a factor than studded tire wear. But $5 million annually is a lot of money, whether it's for being eaten up by studs or plastic flow, and I think we can do a lot to minimize that if we get these mixes right.
Are they, the mixes that we're using today or the last few years, has it changed in the last 10 years or so?
Well, have they? Actually, we just took cores out of C Street. Whether it have crumb rubber, we just took some cores out of that. And we're going to take that apart and see what it looks like, because I think that would be interesting to see if the mix design is radically different or not with that. So we'll find out. We just got the cores the other day, so we haven't got them into the lab to peel and pull them apart yet. But I think lots of things have changed, John. I think the asphalts have changed. I think that, because liquid asphalt is made to a pretty broad band. It's kind of the bottom of the barrel. And I think as the price of gasoline and other petroleum fuels like that have gone up, I have a sneaking hunch that they're taking all the volatiles they can get out of it, and we may be getting a completely different product, you know.
Yeah. Representative Gatto?
Just a question. Are we or did we used to use Saudi oil for the mix, and have we ever used Alaskan oil?
Now it is almost all Alaskan oil. Everything coming out of the Fairbanks refinery, North Pole, is, of course, right out of the pipeline, as is now, I understand. Tesoro and Nikiski was getting oil in by tanker from other sources, but they're telling me now that virtually all of what they're getting is coming out of the pipeline.
So I guess the follow-up is there any correlation between roads that were built with oil from outside Alaska, mm-hmm, as compared to roads built with oil from inside Alaska, and therefore point to the oil? Mm-hmm. And then question number two is the rock hardness. Mm-hmm. I talked to some people about they found some quartz in Healy that are willing to break up and use quartz rather than the current rock, which
sure
is salt.
We're going to talk about that a little bit here, just a little bit later, on the hardness of the rock. On the asphalt, I think there's something to be said for the fact oil that comes off the pipeline, down the pipeline, is pretty high in paraffin. It has a lot of paraffin, and that would tend to lend it
less
softness, more softness than other asphalts, other oils, I think. So I think there is a factor there. There's no doubt about that. I see before, let me think now, before the pipeline, of course, all of it, Chevron was the primary supplier of most of the liquid asphalt up here back in the 60s and 70s when I was traveling up here. And even then, we had problems with hardness of asphalt on some of them. But there's no doubt it was different asphalt. And, you know, I don't know. When we take apart, C Street was paved when, John? 20 years ago, was it? About, I think?
Yeah, something like
that. And it's starting to rut now, by the way. I don't know if it's rutting pretty good. But I did get the cores, and we'll find out what that, and we'll take it apart and see what that looks like for, and see what the asphalt is in it as well. And we can get some correlation, perhaps, to what we're doing today anyhow.
Yeah, Senator Calvert?
Yeah, I understand that the sweet crude makes a better product than, say, our last
sour crude.
That's correct, yes.
But I don't know if it's available up here. I know we've been working on, I've been involved with this for 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, in the past administration anyway, we had DOT, and they kind of dug in their heels, and they wanted to do it the way they've been doing it for a long time. And that's why I was wondering if they have changed. You remember some of the meetings we had in Anchorage on this very thing about the mix.
Yes.
And the attitude that that I got out of some of the meetings, we've been doing it this way, and what do you know about it?
We've brought, and thanks to Leroy's help on this too, but we've brought in the DOT pretty and started working with them. I had meetings on this with Newt Bingham and Mike Santangelo just the other day. They've been very cooperative with us, and I went over this, and I don't see them having any great objection to what we're saying in this presentation. So I think that they're more than willing to work with us at this stage, it looks like. I don't know about other parts of DOT, but I know that those guys are certainly being cooperative and useful, so helpful, I mean, so we'll see. This picture here is of the Glen Highway where we took our samples. We took it just before on the inbound lanes, just before the Muldoon exit. So the traffic was starting to slow down to get onto the off-ramp there at that point. And it's not rutted badly. There's some small ruts, about 3/4 of an inch there is all you can see. And as you get closer, you can see the holes there. You can start seeing what's going on, and you get even closer. And if you look at that, and this gets around to the harder aggregate that we were talking about, mm-hmm. Senator, if you look at that, those rocks are not ground down. What's happening is it's picking the fines out around them, and then the rocks are coming out. Possibly harder aggregate if you went to larger stone in the surface cores. They do that in Europe a lot, and that's what SMA, stone matrix that we've used here for years, that now I think is kind of in disfavor with the DOT. They've decided it's not as good as they thought it was. But stone matrix asphalt, as used in Europe, is big rock. I mean, you go into London or Paris, aggregate in the surface is that big. And I think if you had big, hard stone like that, it could really resist some of this problem, even just bigger stone. Our problem in Anchorage or in Alaska is that we don't have a lot of large stone. I mean, we're using river gravel. And it's, I think even, you know, if you look at those, they're not ground down. And that's 70-mile-an-hour traffic on that. It's just picking the fines out, and they're rolling out. So I'm not sure if the harder aggregate is going to be a factor unless you go bigger stone, because it's going to pick out hard. If you use stainless steel ball bearings there, it would still pick them out.
Right. The binder is what's disappearing.
Exactly. It's the studs are picking out the binder. So where they've beaten that some down in Arizona, they're using rubber. They're incorporating rubber into their surface course, the wearing course. And it's been up in the cold, high country where they have studs, and it's holding up awfully well down there. We went down and spent a week with the DOT and with the down there going over and looking at jobs a year or so ago. So, you know, there's things you can do, and I think we can address this. Our focus has been on plastic flow because of the sites that we sampled. The Glen Highway was the only one that exhibited this particular problem, this nature of problem. And I think it probably is a function of speed. I think most of the roads, like you take the internal roads in Anchorage, most of those aren't the 70-mile-an-hour speed that, that you're going to get on the Glen Highway, and you get this actual picking with it more. This just summarizes what I just told you, I guess.
Jerry, get back to the Glen Highway very quickly. You know, having driven it quite a few times from essentially
the interchange to, let's say, Fort Ridge, but in, into Anchorage. You know, there's a major variance in what's rutted and what's not.
There sure is, from area to area.
Yeah, section to section. There's a major variance.
I noticed that.
What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think it's different aggregates, probably, different mixed designs. I think what we found in this, in these tests here, and I'll show you on the new paving on Tudor Road, it's pretty evident. There were just tiny little variations in asphalt and gradations on that road, and one side's working fine and the other one isn't. And I think that the parameters in which rutting can occur are narrowed down much more. I think we're going to have to go not so much to harder aggregate, but maybe modified pavement asphalt, liquids, maybe more polymer you can do it. There's things you can do in liquid asphalt to, I don't know that crumb rubber is a way to go, but I think incorporating rubber, actually melting it in like they do in Arizona is a factor and could be useful.
Now, the rubber in Arizona, is any of that recycled?
It's all recycled.
It's all recycled.
Yeah, okay. It's all comes from tires, old tires, every bit of it. And the thing is, when they went to crumb rubber, when they first started using it, we tried it here in Alaska, old guys, 15 years ago up in Fairbanks, I think. Wasn't it, Leroy?
Yep.
And it was not very successful, and they tried it down here and had some problems. But the problem at the time was that the feds were mandating that in order to get rid of old tires, that we incorporate a certain amount of crumb rubber into our pavements. I was a member of the National Asphalt Pavement Association at the time. I remember distinctly they fought bitterly on this because they said, here we are trying to design pavements that'll hold up and last, and you're making us throw a product in there that we still don't know what impact it's going to have on it. So they were throwing in tires, and that had, you know, there's cord and there's all kinds of stuff you get out of tires when you shred tires. Now, in Arizona, what they're using is much more, they're getting much more refined in it, and they're using like 35 mesh, I think 35 mesh, I think that's it. 30 mesh, 30, 35 mesh, pretty fine aggregate, pretty fine grind on the, or is it 80? I can't remember. Do you? I think it's 30 mesh. Pretty fine mesh. It's more expensive because it's only the rubber that comes from grinding off truck tires, the outside, not the whole tire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And truck tires are better. Truck tires yield better rubber than car tires, for example. They have higher percent of anti-oxidizing agents and carbon black, and that kind of thing. So those things are all good for asphalt paving too, because they extend the life. If you have it, doesn't oxidize as much, but they have the specs on it much tighter. The asphalt, we went and met with the asphalt rubber folks in Phoenix. In fact, the guy George Way was one of the top engineers in Arizona DOT, retired, and actually now runs the Asphalt Rubber Association down in Phoenix. And they have a lot of pretty spectacular results from their asphalt rubber there.
I might also mention that they've also had a lot of success in California with the same stuff.
Yes, that's true. That's so, right.
Representative Gatto?
Yeah, I believe in California, some of the problems they have with passenger car tires is that the sun tends to oxidize the rubber pretty significantly. If you grind off those tires and put them down flat where they're strongly exposed to ultraviolet, then I just don't know if there's ever been a study that indicates adding this mix. You know, up here it may not be the same significance, but I know they shifted to butyl rubber in California or something else.
Did they?
To take care of tire checking.
Well, I stopped and talked to a guy in Los Angeles. It's Manhole Adjustment Company, Inc. And what they do mostly, they don't adjust manholes anymore, is they make asphalt rubber and sell it to contractors for incorporation into mixes. And one of the things he does is it was kind of a good gimmick on his part, he got the state to write a spec requiring a certain percentage of tennis ball rubber, which is basically natural rubber. He grinds up old tennis balls and incorporates it into it, and that might be a factor. But what they're telling me down there is that actually the antioxidizing agents in the tires is pretty beneficial. They've, what did I hear? I think it's 60% of all of the primary roads in Arizona have asphalt rubber surfacing, just a thin lift. And they've had some spectacular results with it down there.
I know you occasionally see Super Cub Thunder tires.
Yeah.
And when they park them, they cover them with a cover. And
yeah, oh, yeah. Well, they don't want them cracking, that's true. But see, asphalt oxidizes, too. That's one of the very big sources of pavement failure in the hot country, particularly. I think Fairbanks even has some fact. And that's why seal coating has become such a big industry down south in the southern and southeast part of the country, is because asphalt oxidizes readily, maybe more readily than rubber. I don't know. Maybe that's...
I just have one more comment.
Yeah.
I discovered only last year that Michelin made a tire called an ice tire.
Mm-hmm.
And it cost the same as a studded tire. But they said this tire is so good that you have to take it off in the spring because you'll wear it out in a summer.
That's what you have, isn't it, John, or something like that?
I buy them. Only mine is
Goodyear?
Bridgestone.
Okay.
And I've had them on my car summer and winter, three seasons. And if you want to look, you know where my car is, mm-hmm. you can look at them. And next year, I'm going to get another set. But I run them. Yeah. I don't know. I'd put 10,000 miles a year on my car. So.
And they're not aggressively treaded. So I was looking at road wear from the point of view of studs, which you can't get more aggressive.
That's right.
To an ice tire, which does the same thing, which literally is not a smooth tire, but virtually.
What's it look like? I haven't even seen these. I should look at yours, John. What do they look like? Are they striped?
They have, you remember, maybe you do, when they used to make sawdust tires.
Oh, yeah. I remember that very well.
And the sawdust would fall out, and that would be a grip.
Yes.
Well, these are softer rubber.
Ah, okay.
And they're self-cleaning, and I've never failed to get up. You know, when I leave here, I go up to 6th Street, and I don't have to get a run at it or anything.
I can go right
on up. And
sure.
Wait a minute. Now, the Romans had wooden tires.
Or going backwards. Well, I think that... Again, I think that there are some things can be done. They had a George Way down in Arizona. The guy with the DOT had a slide presentation he had just given at some convention, and he had a picture of an intersection where it was all alligator. It was roads crossing, and it was all alligator. And they went in, and they paved with this rubber coating about that thick. They just put that down. It's 20% rubber. In the asphalt. It's a high percentage, and 8 to 10% liquid asphalt of that material in the mix, which is very high. And they put it down, it's almost like a slurry, but it's about inch thick. Anyhow, they put that down, and he has photographs from 1 year, 5 years, and 10 years on that intersection with that one patch of asphalt rubber. And the intersection's continuing to fall apart. I mean, it's just alligatored all over, and there's not one reflective crack through that asphalt at 10 years. I mean, it's quite impressive what they can do with it.
I wonder if there's a variance in braking distance with the rubber on, the percentage.
I'll tell you what. I've watched them. They had some other slides, and I've seen it, too. But on trucks going down the road, he has a video of trucks going down the road when it's raining, heavy rain, with that normal asphalt, and there's just water all over, and it's spreading all over. And with the rubber, there's nothing. I don't know what happened to it, but it isn't throwing it up. It's going off. So I don't know. They've had some great results down there. I mean, this is just one thing that I think we should study when we get into this. And that's where we're getting. That's the next stage of what we're going to do.
Yeah. Now, Jerry, would you... I'm not sure that Representative Gatto is aware of what your project, what you're doing. Would you just repeat that for him very quickly?
On the on our research grant?
Yeah.
About 2 years ago. Well, John and I have been talking about it for a long time, but... A couple of years ago, John and I got together, and we were talking about rutting of pavements, and I was aware of the lab they have at UAF. They have one of the finest civil engineering labs I've ever seen. And that was Lutfi Rod. Dr. Lutfi Rod was in charge of it at that time, wasn't he, Leroy, I believe? Yeah. And so after talking to John, we went up and met with Lutfi and toured the lab, and turns out the lab was primarily used for grad students and to do research work for California, Arizona, and Nevada, or Arizona and Texas. And so we thought, why not use that lab for Alaska and see what we can come up with, and use it to find out what our problems are. So it went from there to where you folks gave a grant of $200,000 to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and Dr. Rod ended up having to retire, and then Leroy picked up the reins from him, and then working with us, and it's, their grad student, is our lab manager. He has a degree in chemical engineering, and so he's up there running this test and in the process getting his master's in civil engineering at the same time doing this. So that's how this is all occurring and how it came about. What we tried to do is take a fresh approach of, instead of just, you know, if you try to stamp out fires all the time, let's figure out what's causing them. Let's figure out what's causing the problem and attack it at its source. And so that's kind of where we got started from on this thing.
Could I mention a couple?
Sure, go ahead, please.
Since you were talking about the rubberized asphalt, I just should mention that a lot of the work that was done in California on rubberized asphalt, particularly fatigue of rubberized asphalt pavements, was done by Dr. Rod for manhole adjusters. And they came up and they provided UAF with a grant to do that study.
I guess, yeah, I did remember that. Yeah, yeah. That's how I met the guy. Luffy put me onto it.
On the second subject that you mentioned a moment ago, both Luffy Rod, John Liu, who's now in Florida, and myself had a grant with DOT to look at traction, tractability of Bridgestone tires against studded tires. And we were shocked and surprised to find, it's been a while since we wrote that report, and I apologize if I might not report it exactly, but it seems to me almost in every case the Bridgestone surpassed the studded tires in tractability. So I was surprised by that. We did it both on ice and on curves and hills and everything else. So I just thought I'd throw that out just for consideration.
But not just the brand Bridgestone, the specific ice tire Bridgestone?
It was the specific tire. It wasn't called an ice tire, but it's the one that was used. I don't remember that particular tire, but it was the one that's specifically designed for tractability in winter and ice roads. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You might look at my car out here. The front and the rear tires. Hmm. The front tire, the rear tire is the third year. The front one's the first year. Because I have the front wheel.
How much are those tires, John? Just about it. How compared to conventional studded tires?
Oh, I think they're better. They're superior.
What did it cost?
Price.
The same.
Dollar wise. What are they?
Oh. I don't know. I put them on Juanita's card.
I bought a set.
Juanita, she believes instead of tires, she even studs her steering wheel, you know. And then won't drive the car in the wintertime. But it seems logical that studded tires would be better, but it's until you experience it, it's not. I agree with you 100%.
Well, that's an interesting point because because there certainly studded tires are a factor in the rutting of our roads there. I don't think they're as big a factor as we previously thought, but they're certainly a factor.
Just from logic, if you have water on smooth ice and you lock the tires, I'm going to guess that studded tires probably are pretty helpful in that they improve the ice.
Absolutely.
In that an ice tire, if you lock the tires again, may just be a ski.
You know, I don't think we found that to be the case.
Is that right? Well, that's delightful.
Because we flushed water on the runway at the Fairbanks International Airport and used that as our skating rink. Mm-hmm. And then we would measure the stopping distance by doing just that, starting a vehicle, running it down there, slamming the brakes, and see how far it would take to stop it.
And you got to remember, most modern cars are anti-lock brakes.
That's true. It's hard to lock them up. Sure. You betcha.
And most of in my car, anyway, the same. If I come here and I start breaking loose with one of the tires, you can floorboard the car, and the computer senses that, and you can't get any RPM up. It will not slip them tires. Yeah. And that's an engineering thing in the transmission, you know.
Sure. Yeah,
instead of the anti-locking brake.
Great.
Anti-skid brake.
Great. These are the cores that we took from the Glen Highway that I showed you the pictures of a little bit ago. And if you'll see here, this is stone matrix asphalt that was put down on that. And SMA by nature is fairly open graded. That means that it's not real tightly bound. There's lots of pores, fairly porous, even though it doesn't appear to be. And the second lift, the second layer, when we took these out, we were going to cut them apart, completely deteriorated. It was falling apart. And if you go a little, if you look at it here, this is a typical section. You shouldn't be seeing all these bare rock. That's not broken. That's uncoated aggregate. The asphalt's been completely flushed off, and that's just dynamite for an asphalt mix. You let that happen to a mix, and you end up with D1. You don't have a mix anymore. It's no longer glued together. So, and here, see again, there's, and the other thing, there's a lot of round rock in this, but if you look at all this, this is, it just crumbles in your hand, that second lift that's underneath the top lift. As long as it's held between those lifts, I think it probably isn't doing any real damage, but water is getting in there some way, I think, and flushing that out. Kind of interesting here, and I know this, this is distance from the exit on the Glen Highway, 200 feet, and then here's right at the exit. Well, traffic is starting to slow down. As they slow down to go off on the exit, you'll see the rutting. This is the depth of the rut here. It's three-quarter, it's up to three-quarter to five-eighths, or, between three-quarter and seven-eighths inch in here is the rutting, mostly. But when you get close to the exit, the rutting is less, and that's because the cars are slowing down and the studded tires are having less of an impact on it. And you get up on the regular 70 miles an hour, it's pretty consistent what it's doing there. This is exactly the reverse of what happens with plastic flow. And I'll show you one. I don't know.
You said this is a studded tire?
That is Glen Highway. That's studded tire wear, yeah. High speed is what causes a studded tire wear.
I think I'm going to count for that, in that a tire that is not trying to propel a car but is simply floating in neutral is only going to, it's not going to impact the road and try to grab like a cat and pull against the road. And so I would expect even studded tires would have a minimal impact as you get off the gas.
As you slow down.
Is what's happening.
That's right.
It isn't maybe that you're going at a slow
speed. That you're pushing. It's trying to dig it in.
You may get high wear at a slow speed.
Right.
If indeed you are.
That's the point.
What I've noticed is as you go up a hill, there seems to be increased wear.
Sure.
And you go down a hill, the wear, even on the same highway, but in the opposite direction.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. Just trying to maintain speed, the tires are always digging. Pushing. That's
exactly,
right. Good point. This is Diamond Boulevard, for example. This is typical of the rutting on that. Now, there again, here's 200 feet from the intersection here, and you can see there, as you get toward the intersection, the rutting gets pretty significant. That's because you've got the tires, the trucks, they're slowing down and stopping, and then they're taking off again, and you got the standing loads, and it's just shoving that mix.
Well, on Diamond Boulevard, a couple, 2 years ago or so, they paved it, and within a week after they paved it, there was ripples in the pavement at the stop sign, near the stop signs to where they'd take off. I mean, that said to me, and I got the commissioner out there, it was in the Knowles administration, I made him come out there and ride that road and look at it.
Yeah,
and it was a screw-up.
Well, Stewart Highway did the same thing, John, about... let's see, 6-8 years ago, we were, the Seward Highway, Wilder paved that. It's not Wilder's fault, I don't suppose, but they paved it and then immediately rutted. I mean, within a week, it was rutting at the
centers. And if I recall on Diamond, the curb, which normally they bring the asphalt right up level with the curb, the asphalt was pushed up higher than the
curb. That's typical of plastic flow. It pushes it up. That's right.
Moved
that's
around.
Exactly right. So on plastic flow... none of the sampled sites showed evidence of subgrade deflection or surface raveling. Of the six sites we've tested to date, on only one, Glen Highway, studded tires might be the primary contributor. We're not sure what impact that failed mix on the second lift below the top lift might have on that rutting. It might be a factor. We're not sure. Testing on all the others has clearly shown that rutting is the result of plastic flow. And the good news is that plastic flow can be corrected utilizing the latest technological developments in mix design adapted to Alaska conditions. And I'll talk about that a little bit because that's kind of the key to this whole program now. In Colorado, they did a study in 1992, and that's one of the reasons, and they've been looking at this for a long time. They did a really extensive study of a bunch of roads, And they found that air voids in the wheel pattern, let me explain what air voids are when we're talking about it. A proper mixed design is one where you have a skeleton of aggregate, if you will, from the largest down to the smallest. And ideally, you want that skeleton to be so it isn't going to compress. When you get stone-on-stone contact, it's not going to compress anymore. And then you just coat each of those particles with a thin coating of liquid asphalt and glue it together. And that's called maximum density. And when you get to that point, if you have 4% voids, they like to think you should have 4% air voids still in there. In other words, there's still 4% openings. The reason, I believe, for that kind of empirical formula is that if you have 4% void still left after you get stone-on-stone contact, that means you really do have stone-on-stone contact. For example, if you had a bunch of tiny rock, small rock, and you compacted, and you could get 4% voids and not have stone-on-stone, and then it would still flow just like putty. And that, I think that's the reason. But anyhow, the key is you want this mix to have stone-on-stone, maximum density, and once you get there, you want 4% voids. So the point is that they're saying in Colorado they found when the air voids in the wheel path were greater than 3%, there was less than 3%, there was a high probability of rutting from plastic flow, and when the air voids in the wheel path were greater than 3%, there was a high probability the pavement would not rut from plastic flow. And so what we're saying there, this is a study from that, and if you look at this, maybe I don't know if you can see it, but this is 3% air void line here, and this is all the different projects they tested in different jobs, different sites. And if you look up here, the ones that have X's in them have rutting problem. And you can see there's only three up there of the whole bunch above that are above 3% that had rutting problems. And actually, in the study, they found that all three of those had other problems that created the rutting, not the air void, not the plastic flow. And the vast preponderance of those below 3% had plastic flow. And what happens, again, that's because you aren't getting true stone-on-stone contact. And so it keeps compressing, and when it can't compress anymore and get down to nothing, and there's no stone-on-stone contact, it flows. And this is just basically what you're looking at, the whole structure. I mean, the structure of a road is subgrade, granular base, and then the surfacing, whatever it is. And this all contributes to the ability to sustain that load from that car tire up there. It looks to me like we're building pretty good bases. I think on these major roads they're doing a pretty good job. And I think the problem is right up here that we've got to deal with now, it looks to us like. So if you get excessive air voids, you get an unstable mix. If you have insufficient air voids, you have plastic flow. This is why I was saying I think the parameters are fairly narrow. In other words, if you have 8 or 10% air voids, you got too much air in there, it's not held together well, and it's going to be unstable, and it's going to deteriorate and ravel. If you get too few air voids, you're going to get plastic flow, and if you put too much liquid asphalt in it, the asphalt then acts as a lubricant and causes plastic flow. So there's all these factors that bear on the design of the mix, and I think we've been, not casual, but I think we've been going under certain assumptions. For example, the Marshall mixed design by which most of our mixes in Alaska are designed. It's a standard test that's been around for 80 years or something like that. I learned it in college 100 years ago myself. And it's a standard test where you take the mix, the proposed mix, and you put it in a mold, and then you subject it to repeated drops of a specific weighted hammer, a certain number of blows, to achieve this maximum density that we're looking for. I think that it is not, in fact, achieving maximum density with a lot of these mixes, and so you get them out on the road and they start failing. I think there's the FHWA has a test they call a simple performance test, and the purpose of that, everything we've got to date, the Marshall test is an empirical test. It just says, based on past experience, if you give this 50 blows with this hammer, it'll give you maximum density. Well, it isn't. So this thing, they have a kneading compactor that kneads it to be sure to get this maximum density and get the stone-on-stone contact. And they have some other tests they run on it. They make big cores in this, and then they core out of the middle to be sure they're getting no effect from the sides of it. There's some very specific testing they do on that. And I think the gear to do that, nobody in the state of Alaska has that gear. I think, and I was mentioning this to Senator Huggins earlier, it's about $150,000 for that gear, the testing equipment to do that. I think we need that in our lab up there, and then we can start getting some designs, because there, with that, they believe you can predict durability of your pavement in the lab. Right now, we can't, not with what we have. We're not getting it.
What about concrete? I think we saw some sections of Tudor Road that were short, but they had concrete.
That's the way on the fly scale they put in there.
Okay.
I put some of those in.
But those bridges that are in Matsu, between Anchorage and Matsu, one of those has got a concrete surface, and one's got an asphalt surface.
Correct.
If you look at the concrete surface, if first of all, you look at the striping, that gets worn off. But
that's
the concrete is also starting to show what looks like studded tire wear.
A certain amount, it'll do it, and it'll be more susceptible in some ways than asphalt because it's brittle, you know, so you can pick away at it. But it won't get plastic flow, that's one thing. I think that the concrete up here, concrete roads, would be enormously expensive. You can do it on roads, on bridges, but I think up here it would be just prohibitive to do it, particularly with our poorer subgrades. Concrete will bridge a certain amount of poor, you know, of irregularities, but the fact is, with most of our roads up here, you'd have to do all the grade prep that you do with asphalt. And a lot of the other states, they don't have to. They have a little better subgrades, and they can put the concrete down on less than perfect subgrade, and it'll hold up and it'll bridge it. Up here, I think it would be just prohibitive to do it, in practical fact. I think we got to use asphalt. I think we're kind of stuck with it just from an economic standpoint. One of the things, the last item there, unless you had something else.
One more.
Sure.
Concrete always has wire mesh and rebar and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That's the only reason it works like it does.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a consideration of putting maybe a fabric under the top lift, between the top lift and the next lift?
I've done it.
Oh, is that right?
We've done it in Anchorage. We did it on Arctic Boulevard here about 15 years ago. You have overlay fabrics you can use, and they help. The purpose of an overlay fabric is to prevent reflective cracking from the cracks on the surface below the old pavement up through the new. And it's effective. The other thing you can do, there are some things that you can do, is basically that's what polymer does. When you put polymer, you've heard of polymer modified asphalt, have you?
Well, no.
Haven't you? Most of the roads in Anchorage, at least, and the highways, are what have the top surface that has what's called polymer modified asphalt. That's one of the things our company does. You take liquid asphalt from either of the refineries, and they have what they call a PG rating, grading for it, performance grading. And that means that, like, PG 5228 means that grade of asphalt will have a certain characteristic and perform to a certain level between 52 degrees Celsius down to minus 28 degrees Celsius. Then to make it a harder, more resilient asphalt, stronger asphalt, you can add polymer to it. Other states, mm-hmm. they just go to the refinery and they make it, but here we can't. We can only get one grade, and that's 5228. So we add polymer, which is a form of rubber, styrene, butadiene, styrene. It looks like coarse crumbs of rice, basically, but it's rubber. And we run it through a thing called a high shear mill and grind it into the liquid asphalt. And it actually, what happens is we have a fluorescent microscope. You can watch it happen with heat, time, and turbulence. It starts unraveling like little balls of yarn, and it links up. And in effect does just what you're talking about, so that when the asphalt, when the hydrocarbon molecules start failing from stress, this picks it up and kind of pulls it back and gives resilience to the mix. We've been doing it. We had the contract at Elmendorf for all their paving for 10 years back in the 90s. Our company did before the company I had. I sold it. All of that had polymer in it, and now virtually all of the major roads that we're paving have polymer in it too, and it's doing basically what you're saying. And so instead of 5228 grading, we can make 5828, 6428, which means that it holds its characteristic at higher, much higher temperatures. So we're kind of doing that in a way.
So when you come out and do a driveway,
mm-hmm.
is that the same mix that the highway gets?
No. It isn't. The driveway mixes are much finer mixes. The driveway guys don't like them. I mean, if you try to use the highway mix on a driveway, highway mix is much rockier. And you got to do a lot of hand raking on a driveway, and it would make a pretty ugly driveway. And so, no, they use not a very good mix. A driveway mix is a fine, pretty unstable mix in general.
I found out.
It cracked. It had a slope. Yeah.
It's always cracked, and it tries to flow away.
That's right. Central paving. That's right. Rogers and Babbler had a mix they called Joe Gear mix. I knew Joe Gear. He was their lab manager, and back in the '60s, and they had pretty dirty material up in the valley. A lot too much fines they were bringing in, or wherever they're. No, it was out of their pit right there in town on Tudor. And so they had this reject, and so Joe got to thinking, so he started making driveway mix out of this stuff, and so they call it Joe Gear. To this day, they call it Joe Gear mix. And
I think the paver used the term state highway mix.
Well,
is that possible that he actually got the same mix?
No.
No.
No. Yeah, I'd say very unlikely.
Well,
very unlikely.
It was only 85 cents a square foot.
That's right.
Well above that
for.
Now.
That's right. Yeah. Anyhow, one last item there, design versus constructability and quality control is an important one, John. And you and I have talked about this before, and that is you got to understand that in this business of building roads, you sample only a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of what you put on the road. And so you can, in the lab, you take and you come up with this perfect mix that holds up forever. But then you get out on the street, and the guys running that stuff, you know, if you think a 10,000 ton of mixed job, for example, that's 20 million pounds. And you've used probably 20 pounds to make that mix design. So you got a million times higher quantity, and you're checking every 500 tons to see how it's going. So that's every 500... thousand, every million pounds you're checking, you're checking for, taking tests in there to check it for quality. So quality control and constructability are really important. I think that we need better, I think, and it's going to cost the contractors and the state money in the end, but I think we need tighter bands on our mixes, and I think we need better control out on the field and different methods of control. I think maybe we're focusing too much on things that are not as consequential as should be. In other words, in a plant, you've got bins that have various kinds sizes of aggregates feeding out of it, and they come up out of that, and you feed a 10% list, 20% list, 30% list to make this mix design. From my perspective, when I was in the construction business, I wanted to take, for every test the state took, I wanted to take three to four of my own. Just to be sure, because I wanted to be sure I was right. I can't afford penalties. And if you check that as that's coming out of that cold feed and get it in and check it over and over and over again, you're better off. And then on your liquid asphalt, if you're doing a big job, the only asphalt coming into that plant is for that job. It's whatever comes in, it has to go out. And so they call it dip the tanks. If you bought 500 ton of asphalt, and 500 ton of asphalt went out, and you know how many tons of aggregate went, you can figure the percentage. To my way of thinking, this is a better thing, and focus more on the blend of these aggregates. What they do now is they go out on the street, and every so many tons, they put a plate down on the pave behind the paver, and you pave over in front of the paver, and you pave over it, and they take that sample, and they take it back and take it apart, and they say, aha, you're high on the asphalt, or low on asphalt content, or you're off on this. When in fact, you're absolutely on. It's just such a tiny sample you're taking, you see. And I think process control is more important than going out on the street. Control the process. And then you've got, and that's something we really aren't doing now. They kind of say you can mix it in a wheelbarrow if you want, as long as it meets spec on the grade. Let's control the process. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, that's just, I think quality control is a big factor that we need to be examined. This is kind of interesting. This is Tudor Road. Before they paved it this last year. And what we have here is, this is the rutted area, second layer. Is it here? Let's see.
The rutted is on the right.
Rutted area is right. The rutted area, top lift. Rutted area, top lift is that one right there. And the rutted area, second layer, you can't tell, it's not showing the code, but it's that one right there. In other words, this is the lift that's immediately underneath the top lift. Mm-hmm. And if you look at this, the idea is that you want a minimum of 3% voids, or you're going to get rutting, all right? And if you get down below that, and what 4% is design, that mix on that top lift was down to 0.2%. There was no voids in that lift at all, which means it just kept compacting. They put it down with 4% originally, probably, and then it just kept compacting, and then it just flowed when it got down to where it couldn't compact anymore. As compared to these here, this is the unrutted areas, and you can see here, that's between the wheel tracks. There's very little difference there, 3.3 and 3.7. It's still down considerably. It should be higher than that because it was laid with higher voids than that. So that's why it rutted. You're way down on the air voids, and it just flows. It has no place else to go. Now, conversely, this is a new pavement on Tudor Road, and this is they used on the eastbound lanes, they used hard aggregate and basically the same broadband mix design as on the westbound. But the difference was they used hard aggregates. And this is between the wheel paths. This is the wheel paths. You can see it's holding up. It's compressed some, but not that bad. This is local aggregate that was done on the westbound lanes. This is between the paths. This is wheel paths. And you can see here, now this was only down a couple of months at that point. And I think we can safely predict that this will rut. It hasn't much yet. Can't see it, but it will rut. And it'll rut pretty soon, probably this summer. And the point is that then the assumption is the only difference is hard aggregate in the eastbound lanes and soft aggregate and local aggregate in the westbound. And I don't think that will have anything to do with it. It has to do with the mix design. That's why it will rut, not because of the harder, softer aggregate.
There's another phenomenon that occurs at the S-turns on the Glen,
mm-hmm.
where people tend to sway across their lanes a lot.
Mm-hmm.
There's no rutting. Whenever somebody is given the privilege of swaying.
Oh, yeah, because they're not running on the same track, of course. Sure.
So,
or you're getting uniform compaction.
So I had this thought, when you stripe the highways, if you could move the stripe
every now and then.
Next year, a foot to the left, and the following year, a foot to the right, you're going to distribute the wear and maybe save one whole paving job.
I've heard that suggested, so yeah. That's a point.
They put us all in a cage, too.
Yeah, that's really. Right. Well, I think the point is here that I'm not sure that hard aggregate will or won't be beneficial. It may be, but I think the biggest thing this is going to say is that when this other side, without this test we've run here, without that, one would look at that and say, okay, this eastbound lanes are holding up fine, and this one rutted. Therefore, the hard aggregate solved the problem. And I'm thinking, I don't think it has any impact on that. Not on this mix. You can't see it. It's not there. It's not happening. So these are just some of the things we need to look at. Our conclusions are that plastic flow is a major cause of pavement rutting due to mixed design and technique, inadequate constructability, and field testing. And Mike Santangelo, in the meeting I had with him and Newt the day before yesterday, in fact, they both brought that up. They said, you know, we can do whatever we want in the lab, but if we get it out there, if we aren't testing it properly and correctly and often enough, and don't process. And again, I think it's process control. Don't control it out on the street. Control it where you're making it. And if you do it there, it's going to come down out on the street okay. I think that's a big difference in thinking that should take place. I talked to Newt and Mike about that a little, even like in the production of our polymer modified asphalt. Generally, to raise the grade up from 5228, PG 5228, 5828 with our asphalts up here, you can add 3% polymer, and it'll get you to 5828 very nicely. But the state will not specify 3% polymer. Instead, they have all these various parameters and all these tests you got to run. And I say, why don't you? And they had a dickens of a time year before last. I wasn't even selling polymer modified asphalt because the testing was so onerous and so unpredictable that you could get a lab to certify that you were in spec, and then somebody else would test it and be off, because the plus or minus on from lab to lab or tester to tester is plus or minus 30%. Well, how the heck can you have a test that's that wide, you know? So now we're working on that. But my point is that just require adding 3 or 4%. That's what Elmendorf does. They've done it for years. Dan Eckert out there has said, put 3% polymer. And I'll certify it when I send you the asphalt. I sign a sheet that says, I certify I put 3% polymer in it. And I think the same thing with the making of hot mix asphalt. The process is it. Focus on the process, not on this little sample you take on the grade. That's important, but focus on the process. If it comes out of that plant where it's making 300, 400, 500 ton an hour, and you've got it going into it correctly, it just about has to come out correctly unless you have some generic problem in the middle. So I think these are things we need to look at as we go along.
I was in the contracting business for a while too, and as my observation, maybe I don't know if you agree, when you bid on a job, you bid to whatever specs they come out with, even if you knew that it could be improved.
Right.
You know, if the specs wasn't as good as it could be, that's not the contractor's problem.
That's correct.
They all are competitive with each other, and they bid it.
Sure.
To do that, and if it's failed, a lot of times the contractor gets to blame for it, but sure. I think it was in the design.
Oh, yeah.
For the most part.
Well, see, that's why, like in Europe, it's very common, and they're doing this back east, going with end result specs, and then you have to warrant it for 5 years or 10 years. Now, that's a bad thing in my view, because most of the smaller contractors couldn't afford to have their bonds tied up that many years to cover the warranty, but they're doing that a lot. They say, okay, build me a turnpike from here to Fairbanks, and you're responsible for the maintenance of it and everything for 10 years, and then they're going to come up with the best mix to be sure that it's correct. But you're right, John. Now you look at the spec and say, oh, that's the easy spec there. That's the loose one. I can meet that. And so you make the easy spec. Sure. You bet.
What happens on runways?
They're different.
They're different. That's right.
I give you that? I asked for the International Airport, that last runway.
Yeah.
Their mix, they got all excited when I asked DOT that.
That's right.
But they give me the specifications of the mix. Of course, most of it's Greek to me, but I think I may have shared that.
I got it. Yeah, they're significantly different, you know. And the construction of a runway is, again, most of my experience on that's at Elmendorf. And, guys, what you do on a runway is radically different. I mean, the airfield base course, the gravel base you put under it, you put it down with a paving machine, big paving machine, and you bring it to optimum moisture content at the plant. And when you build a runway, you build a heck of a structure. You have high fracture aggregate. You discard most all the little stuff and make high fracture. Okay. So you get good keying and the testing is much more restricted and strict and whatever. So, yeah, different stuff.
And one more. Are the autobahns concrete or asphalt?
Most of them are asphalt that I've been on.
And I understand from watching the History Channel, they're like 27 inches thick.
Oh, yeah.
And ours are...
Oh, yeah.
Well, nothing.
Go down to Arkansas or Tennessee or Georgia or any of those places. You'll see them put down, even in Washington, you'll see them laid. The first thing they'll do is build a gravel base. Then they'll put crushed aggregate base course. Then they'll put asphalt treated base, six inches of asphalt treated base, which is just what we did in Washington. I lived down there and sold asphalt plants for several years. Is they take just screen out the top side, maybe take inch and a quarter minus pit run material that's clean, you know, no more than non-frost susceptible, 6 or 7%, 200s of very fines. And then put like 2 to 3% asphalt in that. I did it at Anchorage Sand. I used some of it. I had them make it for me. It works great. I do it for like if they're building a condominium project. You put that down, like put down 2 inches of that. Then they work on that with their forklifts. And then you come back and just cap it off with a 1-inch overlay. It worked great. Cordova Square Apartments has that on it. That's held up all these years. But anyhow, I think that you go down to there, they'll put down ATB, and then they'll put down what they call a binder course, usually 3 to 4 inches of mix, and then a couple 3 inches of mix of wearing course on top. I mean, yeah, huge volumes of mix, much more. We are doing 2 inches usually.
Excuse me one second. Jerry is assuming we get out of Juneau before Santa Claus comes. You might want to invite Carl up to the lab.
I think that'd be very, yeah, we'd be glad to. I'll go up with it. Where do you live?
Palmer.
Okay. We could fly up there and get together with Leroy, and you could meet Javed, and Steve will be there. Sabujan's working with us. Steve Sabujan, he's a PhD, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's DOT research. Mm-hmm. And you taught him, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Anyhow, go up and tour the lab, because I think you'll find that fascinating. It's a heck of a lab, and yeah, by then we'll have some other more results, too.
Yeah, I know it's a different subject, but if you'd give Carl about a 60-second burst on anti-icing.
Oh, sure.
Particularly as it applies to the bridges in Mat-Su that
sure,
we talked about.
Sure. Actually, I'm holding my breath. We have the RFP out. I'm waiting. I should hear this week or next on it. But, I sold our business in 2000 and retired, and then I got bored, and so I went to work with a consultant out of Detroit. And he sent me in to work with an electrical contractor in Grand Blanc, Michigan, who had just engineered a merger between them and a company in Switzerland called Beauchamp, who've been around a long time. They make big snow plowing equipment for airports and stuff. And then for the last 30 years, they developed, invented, came up with a whole system of preventing ice from forming on bridges and at tunnel entrances and exits. And it's not melting it, don't let it form. And what they do is have sensors that you set into the pavement.
They spray
up. The sensor is actually, the key is the sensor. It's called a Peltier device. When it senses moisture on the surface of the road and the temperature gets down to 39 degrees Fahrenheit, it starts cycling. It warms up to melt 2 degrees Celsius over freezing to melt any ice or snow off that might have gotten packed on by trucks or cars going over it. And then it starts cooling down. It can cool down up to, it's a thermoelectric heat pump, really. When you run the current one way, it heats one side and cools the other. When you reverse it, it does reverse of that. So it starts cooling down, and it'll cool down up to 25 degrees Fahrenheit below the surface temperature of the road, and records the data then of where the freeze point is of that liquid that's on the surface. It goes down until it hits that freeze point. It detects the ice is going to form, and it records it. And then you can have a set point that says, okay, when it gets within 2 degrees of freezing on there, when the actual freeze point of that liquid's within 2 degrees of the temperature of the surface, then you spray this anti-icing chemical on the bridge. And they're going to put that on the Connect River bridges, actually both lanes. You mentioned that concrete part of the contract is to overlay the southbound lane, mill it and overlay it because it is rutted some. And then we'll put this system on. That's a big pump house and 2,500-gallon tank.
But I heard it was frighteningly expensive.
Mm-hmm. Not that bad. Well, it's only $1 million for those two bridges, including overlay.
For a bridge on each side?
For both bridges.
In each direction or
yeah, both, directions.
Both bridges in both directions?
Both, no, just the main bridge over the Connect River, both runs, north-south, both mm-hmm. north and south spans, and plus 200 feet on either end of the approach on each one of them, and including the pump house and overlaying the bridge, milling and overlaying the southbound lanes. And, you know, they put one on a system in one of the first in the U.S. in Minneapolis across the Mississippi River and down on I-35W in downtown Minneapolis. It's two 2,000-foot spans with five lanes each direction. It carries 138,000 cars a day. And they put that on in 1998-99. And they did a study. They took the 1999-2000 winter and compared it to an equivalent winter from, I forget what year, 94 or 95. They found one that had equivalent amount of cold spells and ice and snow and whatever. And that study, then based on that study, they took the cost of downtime and waiting and jam ups to the public plus the cost of damage and lawsuits and whatever. And they figure that returned, I think it was $3.40 for every dollar they spent on that system. So it's, you know, it's all a matter of
any of those guys in that 20 car pileup would have.
That's right, including the police officer that was in the middle. But,
yeah.
So, yeah, anyhow, that's the way we're waiting to see it. We're hoping it'll be ours. It should be.
John, I'm sorry, you had.
Yeah, no, it gets back to the international airport. It comes to my mind. Immediately after they put that other runway in and they used a mix, that the planes, as they were sitting or starting to move, turned the front wheel and they were turning the asphalt with the wheel. You remember that?
That's right, pulling from the runway onto the taxiway or vice versa. They were actually getting a separation of the top lift was sliding, and it was, and you could look down and see the second lift right below it. And I talked to Dan Hartman about that. Dan Hartman, isn't it? That's his name?
I don't know.
That's the head of maintenance out there. I've talked to him about that. Part of that, they've experienced that problem in other areas. I've talked to guys, and one of the things, I was at a convention down in Palm Springs with the, it's emulsions and chip sealing and surface treatments and whatever. And they were saying one of the things they're doing in some areas is on that second lift, before you put the top lift on, chip seal it. And chip seal is where you use real angular chips. With the rubberized asphalt, that's what we're using now, is polymer modified asphalt. And chip seal that, and the chips are grabbed. And you can pull a chip up, and it'll snap back with that polymer modification. Put that down, and then put that lift on top of that, and it isn't going to slide on you, because that's what's happening.
It's kind of glued.
It's not gluing down good. That's right. Because they're casual. They're too doggone casual, I think, about the what they call the tack coat. You put down a material that's called SDE1, snap tack. And they always, the DOT always has like 20 tons or something in a job, and they never use a fourth of that, because they go out and they just go fast, you know, and just fog it. And you aren't getting a good seal. You aren't getting a good, you aren't tacking it down, gluing it down. So I think there's some factors there to be considered. Anyhow.
Well, very good. Are there any other questions? Yeah. Well, Leroy, good to see you again.
Thank you.
Yep. And Jerry, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. I'll give you a card. When you get a minute.
And one other thing that we've talked about at some point, based on your findings and the pace, is that we look to maybe have an asphalt summit. At some point in time.
We should, and once we get down to the end of this thing, I think we should have a summary meeting and just kind of round up everything that we've done and explain it, and have contractors and DOT and muni people and airport people and whatever, so that they can benefit, because that's the function of this whole thing. Leroy and I have talked about it. If it isn't implemented, it's going to be a waste of money. We need to get those things we find implemented. So... You bet.
Yeah. Now, our graduate student, I forget his name.
Javed.
Yeah, it's Javed. How much longer does he have left?
Well, he's got at least a year.
Oh, okay.
But he's coming back down. He'll run our lab for us starting in May when he gets out this spring.
Then
he'll go back up in September.
Yeah.
Okay. So in September, first September, we'll begin cranking it up again.
They're paying him some, and I'm paying him his salary, regular salary, so he can afford to do this.
So I'm thinking by fall we should also have one or two more faculty to have a better resource, mind resource, in solving these questions as well.
Right.
So.
Couple of things we've talked about. I'd like to see this lab up there. I mean, it's a wonderful facility. It really is. And at least for the basic mixed design, I don't think they should be doing quality control, but I don't see why, like they had the problem at Dutch Harbor out there where the mix fell apart. It consistently falls apart. Instead of just throwing money at the thing and doing it again, let's go up and figure out what's happening so it doesn't happen again. You know, we've had three pavements out there now that have failed in a very, very short period of time, and everybody has their own pet idea of what really occurred there, but let's find out, you know, let's solve it.
Jerry Newt, he has a grant he's working off of or something, right? Fairbanks?
Newt is?
Yeah. He's up in Fairbanks, right?
He's in Anchorage.
What's the person, the retired DOT person that's...
Oh,
Billy Connor.
Billy Connor. He's with the university now.
Yeah. But he has a sizable grant for 2 to 5 years. Is that about
it's
right?
It's a 5-year grant for UC. It's called UCCTC, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And correct me, that acronym may not be exactly right, but it's a university transportation center funding, and it's a tier one funding, which is significant. And it gives the university an opportunity, and we're not talking about just UAF, we're talking about the University of Alaska system, an opportunity to bring the top research in transportation-related problems to the state of Alaska. And this is an opportunity that doesn't present itself very often, but we're fortunate that that begins this May.
Yeah.
And Billy has been brought on board to direct that effort. And as part of that, we're also in the process of trying to hire between 5 and 7 faculty.
Now, Billy's efforts there now, will that be utilizing your lab then?
That will be utilizing our lab, and we hope to expand that lab to improve it even more. One of the unique features that we have in this lab is that we have the ability to take these pavements and look at them under cold climatic conditions, which many labs cannot do.
That's an environmental chamber.
So we have a $200,000 environmental chamber that Dr. Rod and I, through private donations and some monies from DOT and various ways, and include part of our salaries, put together to get these cold chambers so we could put it around samples while we're testing with these pieces of high-tech equipment.
Interesting, too, to know, one of the first things when Javed got up there, I toured the lab, and I thought, wow, with Lutfi, is the lab equipment hadn't been calibrated in a long, long time because it was never used for anything other than grad students and experience, and so it wasn't necessary. Now you've gotten getting the stuff pretty much back up to where it should be, don't you think, Leroy?
Well, we still have a ways to go. Yeah. Yes, the equipment is top-notch. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And it is the latest that's available through the SHARP research program, Strategic Highway Research Program. There are some things that we do not have that we do need. There's no doubt about it. That's to be particularly look at plastic flow conditions and shear flow. And that's that $150,000 that Jerry was mentioning. Yeah. But there's also, I'm really proud of the fact that we have some pretty sophisticated equipment. Where we've been short lately is we have run short of money to be able to keep it calibrated, and that's unfortunate, but we're in the process of getting that corrected.
So. Stand by one. Mike San Angelo, are you there? Hello, Mike?
He's asleep.
Yep, Mike, we're giving you credit for being asleep.
Excuse okay. me?
Oh, there he is.
Mike, you still there?
I am.
Okay, you're only sleeping for a few moments then.
Yes.
Hey, Mike, sorry about not calling on you earlier. I know you're there for listening only, according to the note I have, but do you have anything you'd like to add, Mike?
Oh, just one thing quickly is that I really like the work that's being done. Jerry and I've talked to Dr. Halsey, too, and I think it's really good work, and I've been talking to upper management here in DOT, and they're wanting to help, and we're looking to do our best to implement whatever we find. That's our goal.
Okay, good. Hey, and Mike, in that sense, you know, I would ask you to, we need to live the philosophy of we're cooperating on this, not competing.
Yeah, that's what we're doing, right?
Right.
Jerry?
You've been great, Mike. Thank you.
Good.
Yeah. And Mike, this is Professor Halsey. I just wanted to thank you for all the things that you're doing to try to help us get the things in the field and the report on the constructability of these things. And that's been very helpful. Thank you very much.
Good. I'm excited for the work you guys are doing.
Good deal, Mike. Look forward to continuing working with you.
Yeah, thanks again, Mike. And with that, we will be adjourned. Thank you very much.